there.
Sure. I think we're just about ready.
Sorry.
It's been a minute.
I'd like to open the House Committee on General Government, Consumer Protection, Tuesday, March 15th. Committee, we've got a few bills up and looks like a couple of work sessions. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3371. Jan, would you give us a little...
Committee Chair and members, House Bill 3371, it requires a person applying for issuance or renewal of a license or endorsements as a residential general contractor, a residential specialty contractor, or a residential limited contractor to certify that the person has at least one responsible managing individual who is a licensed contractor, a journeyman, a four-person supervisor, employee engaged in construction work for a licensed contractor. It allows education or experience to substitute for construction experience, and it applies to applications received by the Construction Contractors Board on or after the effective date.
And to testify before the committee today, we have Representative Wisnett. Welcome to your committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I bring to you today House Bill 3371.
If you identify
for
yourself.
For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Colleagues, I think I would describe myself as usually an advocate for individual freedoms with individual responsibilities. I do not usually support over-regulation or over-mandating. However, a constituent came to me some time ago with some really problems he'd had with a contractor. And this is not reflective, and I know we shouldn't always try to protect that one bad apple, but this was a bad apple situation for my constituent, in that he went to found a contractor to do a major remodel on his home, and everything just went upside down with the subs that he had. My assistant, who worked part-time in a hardware store, when he described what kind of nails the guy used on the garage, which fell down, my assistant, Megan Schinnerwerk, said, "I know that's the wrong kind of nail to use outside on sidings." And her experience was very limited in construction. So I bring this bill to you today to try to help consumers, consumer protection, that's what the committee is about. And I think I tried to find as simple a way as possible, again, realizing I don't want to over-regulate, over-mandate for this industry, and I realize that a lot of the people in this industry get into it for the, you know, is bringing their money and their management expertise, and they go out and find people to sub and build the houses without knowledge. Now, I don't want to stop that, but this bill says, okay, if you, Mr. Businessman, general contractor, if you want to, you know, be a contractor but you have no experience, you must bring forth and show us that you have some record of your staff, your foreman, your subs having had construction experience is required. Back to my constituent, he's had some really bad things happen in his life, and he's losing the house. He's lost the house because he had to take his retirement funds out to repair what the first contractor didn't do. He recovered like $36,000 from the bond. And I want to state here on the record that the support that I got in trying to solve this constituent's issue for Mr. Craig Smith, the administrator of the Contractors Board, was beyond the call of duty. Mr. Smith did an extra special job and spent a lot of extra time researching this constituent's concerns. And we had a meeting here in Salem with him, and we narrowed down the two things that we thought would help this gentleman, or it's not going to solve his problems. It's not retroactive, but these are things he thought were needed to help protect people from going through what he went through. And one of the things Mr. Smith was able to do through the Contractors Board was to be sure that people understand that a builder has a bond, but that bond doesn't cover the complete cost of the project. And so you can buy private insurance to cover your investment. And so that's now a record of the contract, I believe, if there's any testimony. But that's not what this bill is about. This bill is about when the general contractor comes in to get his license. The bill's pretty simple. The Section 2, you know, talks about what kind of contractors that this applies to, and then you go through Section 3. And again, it states each one of them shall have a managing individual with two or more years of construction experience. For a residential general contractor, residential specialty contractor, a residential limited contractor. I think this is the best I could come up with to be a minimum requirement impact on the industry and the businesses that people are doing, but provide some sort of protection for the consumer. So, Mr. Chair, that's my presentation. If you have questions and if committee members have questions, I'm available. And I'm not a builder.
Questions from the committee?
Well, you know who's late.
Lock the door. Gertz and Wisnett, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I think it looks like a well-intentioned bill, and perhaps we can work it a little later on.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Next up, I have Kathleen Dolan from the Construction Contractors Board.
Good morning. Chair Holby, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Dolan. I'm the policy analyst for the Construction Contractors Board. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 3371, which would require residential contractors to have experience before becoming licensed. We are taking no position on the bill, but we have come before you today and hopefully maybe some testimony that might be useful for you to understand the bill a little bit in light of how our statutes work or the statutes that you've written that we administer work, and also how we might administer the bill if it became law. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to help answer those as well. What this bill does is it requires that a residential contractor other than a developer must have a responsible managing individual, we call these people RMIs, with certain experience or education and experience. And the RMI is a person who is an owner or an employee of the company who exercises management or supervisory authority over the construction activities of the business. If they were an RMI before July of 2000, they're not required to take any prerequisite education or pass a test, but after that time, they are required to take a 16-hour class and pass a test measuring their knowledge of business practices and laws. This bill would add as a requirement that they have two or more years of construction experience, and in some cases, education may substitute, such as an apprenticeship or a bachelor's or master's degree for some of that experience. This bill is very similar to the current requirement we have for commercial contractors, which became law in 2007 as part of House Bill 3242. There are a couple of distinctions. That law requires that people who are designated as key employees have the experience, and experience is aggregated together amongst those folks, so that's a little bit different here. And also, if you look at page 4 of our testimony, you can see there's sort of a chart there. The commercial folks need between 4 and 8 years of experience, depending upon which commercial license they have. If this were to become law, we would probably administer it the same way as we administer the commercial contractor requirement, and we set forth in part of your testimony packet pages of our application. We require people to complete a certificate of experience on our application form, to sign that is a true and correct statement, and it lays out and explains to them what level of experience their various individuals need. There are penalties, of course, for falsifying the application form. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to help answer them.
Questions? Representative Conger.
So the current law is that there is no experience required for a general contractor's license, correct?
There's no experience required for residential contractors.
For residential contractors.
Correct.
Thank
it's
you
only
for
commercial contractors.
Yeah, for distinguishing that. May I follow up?
Follow up.
How many complaints? This may be difficult to answer, so if it is, don't feel like I'm putting you on the spot. But if you have the information, how many complaints would you think the Construction Contractors Board gets that are attributable in whole or in part to the inexperience of the contractor?
I don't know that we have that information. We probably don't. But we do get a number of complaints that have to deal with bad work.
Yeah. Thanks.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this prevent a handyman or someone doing small sort of projects around a residential home from doing that?
It would only prevent it to the extent they would have to have 2 years of experience. They're included.
The handyman would have to have a two-year license.
The folks we call limited contractors, but they're residential contractors. The only people who are not included are developers.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to figure out how we would verify what experience is.
Chair Holvey, Representative Cameron, the method we use right now for the commercial contractors is probably the same method we would use, which is to ask them basically to self-certify their experience as part of the licensing and renewal practice. We ask them to tell us that they have that level of experience. We explain to them what's needed and then have them sign a certification statement.
Follow up. So if somebody has moved a wheelbarrow full of concrete and lifted up roofing materials for a couple of years as a day laborer, they could basically, even if they hadn't done that, they could just come in and say they had done it and there's no way to go back and verify. So a bad apple could continue to be a bad apple.
Representative Holvey, Representative Cameron, we license about 40,000 contractors in this state. We simply don't have the resources or the ability to verify every one of those statements, but if we do have complaints about particular contractors, and most of our enforcement is complaint-driven, not all but most, we will go back and look at their application forms oftentimes, and if there are statements that are false, that can be a basis for a sanction against the contractor, including losing their license.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Darling, thank you for your testimony. I think Representative Matthews and Chair Holvey and myself served on this committee during the interim, so we knew about all the work that went into to trying to come up with this chart. Could you maybe talk to the committee about why the decision was made in the past not to require the residential education or some other license like this bill calls, or education construction experience like this bill calls for?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, the previous bill that created the experience for commercial contractors was House Bill 3272 in 2007, and I know Representative Holvey is quite familiar with that bill. That was the bill that created basically the endorsements, the commercial on one side, the residential on the other. I think there was a thought at the time that largely the commercial contractors were a lot of folks who had large operations. And that wasn't generally true for all of them, but that was true for a lot of them. They would have multiple employees, and a lot of those people would be getting education, getting experience before they came onto the jobs. Whereas that wasn't always the practice with residential contractors. So for reasons I'm not entirely privy to, a choice was made to, include that for the commercial and not for the residential.
Follow up.
Thank you. Representative Sheehan brought up a point about the handyman. Now, under the limited, that's $5,000 per job, did you discuss making that lower so that, you wouldn't have to have it for a $1,000 or $500 handyman project? Is that...
Representative Holvey, Representative Wisnett, perhaps I misunderstood Representative Sheehan's question. I thought when we were talking about the handyman, we were talking about somebody who is a licensed residential contractor but does small jobs. We often refer to that as a limited contractor. But there can also be an exemption, which is somebody who doesn't have to have a license at all if the job is really small. I mean, a true handyman job, like a casual occurrence, I can't remember if it's $500 or $1,000, but there's a dollar limitation. Those people don't need to be licensed.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. You talked about you would administer the program, so do you think this, you know, would this cause an unfair burden on you? Like you said, you have enough now that you're not really, can't check them all anyway, so is it really providing a security blanket for the consumer? Is it, do you have an opinion on that or comment you could make that to this committee?
Well, Chair Holby, Chair Wisnett, as I indicated, we would likely administer the program if it became law the same way as we administer the current commercial program, which is requiring the contractors to certify to us that they have the required level of experience in explaining to them what that means. That would not be a burden on us to administer this for the residential contractors. Again, if there were complaints and we followed up, we would, you know, follow the same practice we would do now, and again, I don't think that would create any additional burden for us.
Make a comment to the committee, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. I'd like just the committee to realize that what happened here is the gentleman, you know, he exercised, he got his bond money back that the contractor has to provide him, but it was like $35,000 or something. The project, he had a loan for $200,000 to do the remodel. And he checked into some legal recourse, but then you're into paying legal fees and all that. And I believe, I'm not certain, but I think the contractor left the state. So, you know, it was more difficult for him to try to recover. So I'd just like the committee to know that that circumstance I didn't bring forth at the table. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Conger.
Just one final question. Have you looked at other states and whether or not they have experience requirements like this and whether they're similarly administered and et cetera?
Chair Holby, Representative Conger, specifically to researching this bill, no, I have not looked at other states. Over the past years, doing what I do, I've looked at a lot of other states' laws on contractor licensing. They vary all over the place, from states that don't regulate at all to states that regulate by specific type of trade. So, you know, I would say Oregon is probably slightly more to the level of more than less regulation for its contractors nationwide.
Thank you.
Other questions? Not seeing any more questions. Comment, have you... Has the Construction Contractors Board weighed in on this particular bill yet, or have they looked at it, do you know?
Representative Holby, referring to the board itself, I don't know that they've actually had a chance to look at this bill yet, no.
Okay. Do you anticipate that they will?
Representative Holby, I do anticipate they will. Normally we keep them apprised at each of their board meetings of what all the ongoing legislation is. I think the next upcoming board meeting is in April. And they Craig Smith may talk to them about it sooner. I know he has an ongoing, you know, conversation with the chair at least, I think, once a week or so.
Thank you. It would maybe be useful to get some feedback from that board. Maybe even before their next meeting, if possible.
I'll pass that on, yes.
Thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3371 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3413. Jen, could you give us a description of the bill and the amendment before us?
Committee chairs and members, House Bill 3413, it requires each urban renewal agency to determine each year whether the maximum indebtedness of the urban renewal plan will be fully paid within the year, and if so, it will notify the county assessor. It requires the Secretary of State to conduct an audit of each urban renewal agency in Oregon every 5 years. It requires Secretary of State to issue a report of each audit. And it requires the Urban Renewal Agency to reimburse the Secretary of State for the cost of the audit. And before you, you have a dash one amendment, which deletes the provisions relating to the audits by the Secretary of State.
Thank you. And I think up first, we'll have Alex Collier and Sue. I hope I don't mispronounce your name. Cut to George?
Interesting.
Cousin George? Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Co-Chairs Wisnett, Holy, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. Before you, you do have a letter from me. It does indicate that the Lane County Board of County Commissioners does see this bill as an important measure with regards to the notification of the assessor for purposes of the Urban Renewal Agency's notifying the assessor that the maximum indebtedness and the debt related to urban renewal agencies has been met, and that there shall be clarifications to the notification provided to the assessor at the very end, obviously, of the renewal urban renewal agency's life. I did indicate, provided an excerpt to you in the letter, in the testimony here today, of a letter that the Board of County Commissioners did send to the Lane County delegates of the Oregon Legislature, speaking to the experience that Lane County had had as the City of Eugene renewed their urban renewal district. And there were several concerns raised in the letter, but one of them was notification of the assessor. We would note that in taking a look at the language in 3413 as drafted, it does speak to a 60-day notification window where the urban renewal agency should notify the assessor that the urban renewal district has met its obligations and is coming to a close. We think that there's probably an easier way to do that for both the assessor and the urban renewal agencies, which is through notification of the annual reporting. There's a UR50 form that is prescribed by the Department of Revenue, and it's an annual notification such that the assessor can certify the tax roll. It may be easiest for both parties to actually just add something to that form that says this is now coming to a close during the 12-month window that report is designed to inform the assessor about. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. You identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is Sue Kutso-George. I'm the finance director for the City of Eugene. I'm here to express some concerns about HB 3413. First concern is that the bill requires that each agency make a determination about whether the maximum indebtedness on their plan will be fully paid within the subsequent 12-month period. And that determination is to be done January 1st of each year with notification to the assessor within 60 days. Our main concern with this provision is it doesn't line up with our budget process. So our budgets go from July 1 to June 30th of each year. And as part of our annual budget process, we are required to file a form, the UR50 that Alex talked about, with the county assessor. We would suggest that this provision of HB 3413 be changed so that that timing and process lines up with our current processes and notification to the assessor. Second, the bill requires the Secretary of State audits, and I understand that there's an amendment before you that would take that audit requirement out. I just wanted to speak to that for a minute. It's not really very clear from that language what the Secretary of State would be looking for in those audits. The criteria and standards aren't set out, and the bill calls for potential criminal prosecution arising from the audits. So we'd want to know a lot more about what was intended, what the intended outcome would be from those audits. If they're financial audits, we would argue that that's redundant, as we already do financial audits under ORS 297. That section of the statutes mandate municipal audits every year, and those standards are set by the Secretary of State. We perform those audits. We send the results to the Secretary of State. In addition, we post several years of audits on our website for everyone to see, and we believe that we are already providing an adequate financial audit and that additional audit requirements are not needed. They're duplicative and an unnecessary expenditure of public funds. If the legislation is calling for a performance audit, we would argue that this would be an infringement on our local control. We have a high standard for making urban renewal decisions in our community. Eugene completed an urban renewal plan amendment process in June of 2010 after 18 months of community dialogue.
In January of 2009, we kicked off the process when our council unanimously supported an economic development statement. The council and community then went through a vigorous process to determine what the goals of our downtown development effort should be and how those goals should be achieved. Urban renewal was one of several paths that the council could have chosen, but they ultimately decided that urban renewal was the least expensive option with no additional cost to the taxpayers and without taking away any additional resources from our general fund. This decision was arrived at after 14 city council meetings, a public hearing, a random sample survey, several public input events and open houses, a review by our Eugene Redevelopment Advisory Committee, a review by the Planning Commission, input from our overlapping taxing districts, including the county, and including concurrence from our school district. We set up a website where citizens could get all of the most up-to-date information on what we were doing, and all of these meetings were extensively covered by the media. It was a very open and transparent process. The result is a targeted downtown urban renewal plan that has projects aimed at sparking increased private development, creating new jobs, supporting Lane Community College's downtown center, and creating a safe and vibrant downtown. In addition, the LCC project, which broke ground last week, will redevelop a blighted area, provide over 300 construction jobs, add 45 permanent jobs, and house over 200 students in our downtown. It'll be a model of sustainability for our community. You may be familiar with this project because the state is also contributing $8 million to it. Eugene's urban renewal contribution was a critical piece of funding that allowed this project to move forward. Eugene has followed all of the urban renewal laws and developed a plan and projects that are designed to meet the goals set out by the legislature in ORS 457. Having a Secretary of State performance audit in our local community's decisions around the use of tax increment financing would be second-guessing what our council and our community has determined is the most appropriate funding for a set of locally determined projects. So, to close, I reiterate that we believe the language included in Section 2 and 3 of this bill are at best unnecessary and potentially an erosion of local control. The language included in Section 1 could be improved by lining up the timing with the current budget and notification timing. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Perhaps maybe not a question, but a comment on the idea of how obviously we've taken the Secretary of State audit out of this bill. I didn't think it was really workable, but I think the intent of the bill was to look for some sort of accountability that in this particular case, urban renewal agencies are following the law. And in regards to the performance audit, your comment, I believe, was that it would be an infringement on local control. And so I would ask, in that respect, then where is the oversight to make sure that the renewal or the urban renewal agency is following the law? For example, if an urban renewal agency does its own audit and if they decide to spend money on uses that aren't allowed by law, who, you know, for operational costs, for example, or using urban renewal monies and not returning it to the taxing districts as required by law. It was that kind of oversight. Where does that occur?
Well, the city council is the oversight for our urban renewal agency, and the citizens of our community are the oversight of our city council. And we do financial audits. So we believe there's...
Do you do performance audits?
We don't do performance audits, but as I said, we have our council and quite a lot of public input. Not everyone's going to agree with the decisions that our elected officials will make, but they have opportunity to have input, and I believe that in our process, which happened last year, our council did make adjustments based on the input from folks along the way to limit further the number of projects, the length of time that our urban renewal district would be in operation, and so forth. So our elected officials take that input, they respond, and you know, ultimately, if the voters aren't happy with that, they can refer. No one filed a referral measure on our plan amendment. That would be an opportunity for the citizens to say this wasn't what we wanted, and they didn't do that.
So I can appreciate that, but in the same light, what you're saying that is that if the elected officials in the city of Eugene's case, mm-hmm. you know, approve it, then it is considered to be following the law, essentially, the ORS statutes around urban renewal, and that's sort of my question is that other than the city councilors approving it, is there anybody else that looks at that and says, yes, this does follow the statutes?
No different than anything else that our city government does every day. You know, this is, mm-hmm. I don't know what makes urban renewal different from any other level of government. We operate on a day-to-day basis, and everything that we do, we don't have someone overseeing every decision that we make and making sure that it's legal every time we take an action.
Good point. Thank you very much for your testimony. No other questions? Next up, I have Barbara Cartmell. Scott Sedaris and Mark Landauer. Good morning. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey. I'm Barbara Cartmell with Clackamas County Department of Transportation and Development, and I'm here today representing AORA, the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. But I am going to forego my particular testimony this morning and see, given Eugene's testimony and some of the comments some of my colleagues have.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Vice Chair Smith, Vice Chair Sheeman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Sedaris. I'm offering testimony on behalf of the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. With the Dash 1 amendments, we respectfully request that we be allowed leave to work with staff to come back to you with the most comprehensive way to give notice to the assessor. I respectfully suggest the assessor needs more than notice. The assessor needs reliable information at a time that's a logical part of the assessment process, and that information needs to be submitted not just to the assessor, but made available to the public at large. We'd like the opportunity to work with that in the interim. One of the points, if I may be permitted a moment, is Chair Holvey, you asked about performance measures, and that is something we have genuinely struggled with. Our urban renewal agencies are audited each year. The standards that are applied are the same as the Secretary of State's standards, that is, the government auditing standards. However, what happens with an urban renewal district is you're looking at an entity that makes a few very large transactions. And so we're looking at situations where local elected officials, guided by citizens and their various budget committees, make decisions as to whether it's a good idea to build a library, a road, to give economic incentives to business, to do affordable housing, or to send the money to the overlapping taxing districts. Those are decisions involving local discretion. We found performance audits a difficult measure to apply in that situation.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, my name is Mark Landauer. I'm here representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association has approximately 900 special districts as members of our association, and thank you. I would just like to point out, as you may recall, last session, 2009 session, the legislature passed a rather comprehensive reform of urban renewal. Leadership in this building asked all the stakeholders to sit down. They frankly were tired of the bitter fighting that had been taking place for many years over urban renewal and the various impacted stakeholders. They directed all those stakeholders to sit down and work out a compromise that we could all live with. As a part of that compromise, under House Bill 3156, if I recall correctly, the group created what we refer to as the Urban Renewal Oversight Committee. That oversight committee includes several entities, including the special districts, Multnomah County, Clackamas County Fire Districts, Association of Redevelopment Agencies. I could go on. It's a rather long and comprehensive list. I wanted to just inform you that that oversight committee is meeting tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. We had welcomed the opportunity to work with both Lane County and the City of Eugene at that meeting to see if we can come up with some language that we can all be comfortable with and come back to you and report on that, and hopefully be able to all give a thumbs up to the outcome. So with that, I'd like to conclude my testimony.
Questions? So it, I'm just to follow up with that on the proposal that's before us with the Dash 1 amendments, which takes the performance audit from the Secretary of State essentially out of the bill. It's just the language about the notice to the counties on the indebtedness. Do you think that's a very difficult subject matter to come to an agreement about that would take more than a couple of meetings, or is this, I mean, you referred to working on that during the interim, and somebody else says, well, maybe it's not quite that complicated.
Chair Holvey, I would respectfully suggest that we have an extensive dialogue among the assessors and extensive dialogue with the overlapping taxing districts. I think we can easily accommodate the changes proposed by the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. Well, I hope you can keep this committee informed on that dialogue and any suggested changes that you might see or would be beneficial to this would be great.
We'll make this agenda item number one and move forward and get back to the committee as expeditiously as possible.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Not seeing anyone else signed up to testify on House Bill 3413, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3413 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3414. Jan, can you give us a little summary of House Bill 3414, please?
Yes, committee chairs and members. House Bill 3414, it allows former judges and former county clerks who meet the requirements to solemnize a marriage and to collect a personal payment not to exceed $100 plus actual costs. It requires the presiding judge of each circuit court to keep a list of former judges authorized to solemnize marriage and to make the list available to the public. It requires the current county clerk to keep a list of county clerks authorized to solemnize marriage and to make the list available to the public.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And up first, Anthony Behrens. Good morning. Welcome.
Good
if
morning.
You'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Certainly. My name is Anthony Behrens. Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be heard today on House Bill 3414, and I thank Chair Holvey and his staff for all the help with this bill. To provide you with some background about me, I'm a resident of Salem and have lived in Oregon all of my life, all 25 years. Just see if you're paying attention. I'm a graduate of South Salem High School, Willamette University, and Willamette University College of Law. After experience as a prosecutor and an administrative law judge, I was lucky enough to serve on the Marion County Circuit Court as a circuit court judge pro tem from 2005 to 2007. As you're probably aware, a judge pro tem is essentially an employee judge. Rather than elected or appointed judge with all the same duties essentially and responsibilities and authority as a judge. In that capacity, I began officiating weddings and have just kept doing it ever since. It's something I really enjoy. I have an opportunity to meet all kinds of different people, go to different places. You are part of someone's life on one of the most important days of their lives. You see people at their best, and depending on the day and how it's going, sometimes they're worse. In the last 5 years, I've probably, I've officiated over 1,000 weddings all throughout the state of Oregon, and have married people from each one of your districts, as well as married people, done multiple weddings in almost all of your districts, with the exception of Chair Wisnitz and Representative Congers. Without fail, almost every couple I've met with has had difficulty finding a trustworthy, qualified officiant to solemnize their marriage. In addition to the practical problems this presents, for example, officiant showing up late, not showing up at all, not really knowing what he's doing, even falling asleep during a ceremony, calling a bride by the wrong name. This is a consumer protection issue. And it's the reason that is because, and I've attached to my testimony, the wedding license actually has all of the information necessary to steal your identity. It asks for a mother's maiden names, address, dates of birth, occupation, and has an original signature of both by bride and the groom on the document. A wedding officiant has unfettered access to the wedding license because he or she completes it after the wedding and files it with the county. And actually, most counties provide a copy of the document for the officiant, usually with the exception of the Social Security part there down at the bottom of the document. Unless a couple is a member of a church or happens to know someone, typically they'll have to essentially turn to a stranger to officiate their wedding. Many couples go to Craigslist or other internet sites, and as you can imagine, there's no assurance that the officiant's going to show up, let alone keep their personal information safe. I will typically ask for a $50 deposit to hold the date, and frequently a couple will actually send me that deposit without ever talking to me or meeting with me. Less than 1% of the time have I ever been asked for references. I'm certain that this is probably the same for most officiants. However, I would think the deposit is probably much higher. My rates are relatively cheap. I use the current statutory structure that apply to judges right now. And so typically that results in about $100 for a wedding in Salem and $150 for a wedding in Portland. Judges currently are allowed to accept a personal payment of $100 for performing a wedding outside of the courthouse, and this is a maximum amount. They don't have to charge that. It's just something they're allowed to do. From my discussions with couples, rates typically start around $300 and go up from there and include mileage and travel fees. This last weekend, I was contacted by a bride who was quoted $495 for a local wedding. And considering weddings, for the most part, on average, take less than 30 minutes or so, she thought this was somewhat absurd and was actually confused by the $115 that I told her it would cost, and actually thought there was something wrong with me because I wasn't anywhere near the market price. But this is the amount that judges are currently allowed to charge. I think judges are currently one of the best alternatives for trustworthy wedding officiants. In my experience, however, relatively few judges officiate weddings outside or even inside of the courthouse, given their workload and their limited amount of free time. To give you an example, in December I was contacted by a couple who had just moved here from Arizona. They had limited funds, living in a fifth wheel, and they just really wanted a legal ceremony to actually legally get married. I think maybe there were some disability issues or something like that. And that typically, a wedding like that really only takes 15 minutes, like 15 seconds, because literally you ask them, do they take each other as husband and wife, and then, fill out the license. And I'll typically charge $50 for something like that, just because it takes time to get there and fill out the license and that sort of thing. And they were in such dire straits, they had to actually sell property just to pay the $60 to get the license from the county. And so I suggested that they turn to the Marion County Circuit Court and contact some judges there to see if they could help them out. Because at the courthouse, the court will charge a $25 fee to do a wedding. But they'll waive that fee if the couple is indigent or can't afford it. They were thankful, and they ended up contacting about four or five of the judges that officiate weddings. But unfortunately, they weren't able to schedule anything sooner than a couple of weeks, and by that time their license would have expired. I ended up marrying them, it's kind of a funny story, at a table in the mall in front of Nordstrom's, and my wife was a witness, and some guy from Verizon was also a witness. I didn't charge them anything. I was just happy to help them out. So I bring to you House Bill 3414, which is intended to address some of the problems that I've just talked about. The language of the bill right now is not quite what I had envisioned or proposed, but I think there are some amendments currently in the works. And so what House Bill 3414 should do after these amendments are really only three things. And the first one is it will increase consumer access to trustworthy officiants who have demonstrated a commitment to public trust and public service by authorizing former judges and former county clerks who have served for at least 1 year to solemnize marriages. And in talking to some of you yesterday, you had raised some very good points about having some additional sideboards to kind of ensure the trustworthiness of these people. And so kind of a couple of things I came up with, and currently in the bill right now, at least on the former judge side, would be that the judge be a member in good standing of the state bar. And since county clerks typically aren't lawyers, that perhaps they would have a conviction of a misdemeanor involving dishonesty or theft, or a felony would make them ineligible. And the second thing the bill would do after amendments is require county clerks who keep a list of judges who officiate weddings to expand this list to include former judges and former county clerks. And I attached a list that Marion County used to use. They use a similar list, but obviously the names have changed because I'm not on that list anymore. But it gives you an idea. It's basically just a Word document. It's less than a page. And from my experience, almost every county I've dealt with uses a similar list. In talking to the Association of Oregon Counties, however, it appears that at least eight or nine counties don't use the list. Under the wording of House Bill 3414 now, it would require counties to keep such a list, even if they didn't keep a list. That is not, was never my intent. It's basically kind of, as Chair Wisnett was describing his bill, to regulate light. So if the county kept a list, then they would be required to add the former judges and former county clerks. However, if they didn't keep such a list, there would be no requirement that they start keeping a list. Also, the bill should clearly indicate that, for example, Marion County would not have to put a former judge from, say, Malheur County on their list. It would just be someone that actually served in that county. That way, the county pretty much knows who is on their list. And then the third thing the bill would do would be to encourage current judges to officiate more weddings. And so the personal payment I talked about would be increased from $100 to $200 for out-of-courthouse weddings. This is just, again, a maximum amount a judge can ask to perform the ceremony. The judge is under no obligation to accept the money, can do it for free. And then this idea is actually borrowed from Senate Bill 488, which is in the Senate counterpart to your committee at Senator Bonamici's bill. And this payment would extend to former judges and former county clerks. And I hope that you agree that these improvements to Oregon law will result in greater protection for Oregon consumers and by increasing their access to trustworthy wedding officiants and encouraging more active judges to officiate weddings. There is no cost to the state or counties as a result of this bill, and it does not raise taxes or government fees. And I hope that I can count on you to support the bill and the changes I've outlined. And I thank you, for allowing me to testify and welcome any questions that you might have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Clem.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing this bill. Do you know if anything in here affects people who are... So my friend bought a degree off the Internet for religious divinity, and he does a few weddings here and there. Does anything do affect Reverend Jace's wedding abilities?
No. I didn't. My goal wasn't to try to eliminate people from doing that or regulate those people in any way. Hopefully, for the most part, and I'm sure your friend is one of them. They do a great job, but I
it seems to.
Other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you for your testimony and bringing this issue forward. It looks like there is some concern that you're revealing to us, and we'll hear some more testimony at this point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, I have Mike Eliason and Patty Powell. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Of course. Co-chairs Holby and Wisnett and members of the committee, I'm Patty Powell, and I'm Assistant Legal Counsel for the Oregon Judicial Department and the State Court Administrator's Office. And it is for the Oregon Judicial Department that I present testimony today. My brief testimony is an overview of the concerns that the Judicial Department has with House Bill 3414 as it is drafted. We have not seen the Dash 1 amendments, and we also learned from the proponent that there are more amendments coming. So we can't speak to those amendments, whatever they are. So my testimony is just about the bill that you're looking at right now. OJD is not quite sure what problem 3414 is attempting to fix, because currently senior judges and Plan B judges already have the authority to solemnize marriages through a Chief Justice order. This has been the practice for many years. As currently drafted, the bill would require local courts to keep lists of judges who have qualified. That means having performed 25 wedding ceremonies when they were active, if now they are retired, and make those lists available. It's unclear why the performance of 25 wedding ceremonies is set as the benchmark. And it's also unclear to us why the presiding judge would be required to keep a list when it is the county clerk that keeps all marriage records, provides marriage licenses, accepts marriage licenses for filing. And also the county clerks who currently in many counties keep those lists of judges active and retired who can perform wedding ceremonies. OJD has sent this bill out for review by presiding judges and trial court administrators for comment on any impacts, financial or workload, that they see. And if this bill goes forward, we'd be happy to work with this committee and its staff to minimize the workload and fiscal impacts, and also to sort of sort out the confusion between what is already allowed by Chief Justice order and what the bill is promoting. I'd like to thank Representative Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, and the committee for allowing me to testify today, and I would be happy to address any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Powell. Let's go ahead and have Mike's testimony first. Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. County clerks actually are, for the most part, okay with this bill. In fact, a few of them said they might take advantage of this when they are a former county clerk in the future. However, there's just a couple of small things. I think a couple of slight misconceptions and... I'll just clear those up real quick. Most counties actually that responded to me actually said that they don't maintain a list. A few do as a courtesy to judges. In fact, Marion County said that they do. In fact, as I think you saw in Mr. Barron's testimony, they do maintain a list as a courtesy. However, the combination, and I know that Mr. Barron's mentioned there'll be amendments, The language of being able to go into one county and one side of the state and then expecting, you know, all counties around the state to maintain a list, that's probably unrealistic. In fact, counties don't even maintain a list of religious clergy who are ordained to perform ceremonies, to the best of our knowledge. So there's the requiring of a list is a little bit... probably questionable from clerk's perspective, but otherwise the bill is, we have no objection with the intent of the bill. So, thank you
both. Committee members, questions for these witnesses? I could have asked them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so my understanding is that the list would not be required if the county does not already maintain the list?
Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron. Yeah, according to the amendments that
we haven't
Mr.
Barron's,
that we haven't
right.
seen, that would be the case, and
okay.
that certainly makes it better. But even in those counties where they do as a courtesy, they've raised questions on you know being putting in the statute that they're required to maintain a list and some of the questions that arise from that, and when to take someone off, when they're ever going to be notified that someone is no longer performing weddings. They just thought that that probably wasn't necessary to be put in the statute.
Follow up, if I may.
Yes, sir.
Sure. So I have not seen the amendments, but if the amendments were to say may maintain a list, that would be less of a problem for counties versus shall maintain a list?
Representative Cameron, yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I guess I have to make a comment. Should have asked Anthony this, but I want to be sure that this doesn't authorize legislators or former legislators that we
Mr. Chair,
colleagues.
Chair.
Yes, sir.
$200 would be a little bit more than our per diem.
I know that was retirement.
Okay. No, is there no other questions for this group? Then thank you very much for your testimony, and I think there was a lot of good comments about. We don't want to do a mandate, but permissiveness we could maybe look at. So, thank you.
Thanks,
everyone.
So, hopefully, the proponents and opponents may have a discussion about potentially seeing if something can come together on this bill.
Yes, sir.
With that, I'll close a public hearing on House Bill 3414. And I'm going to stand at ease for a minute. Protection and open a work session on House Bill 2280. Jen, can you describe House Bill 2280 before I take a motion?
House Bill 2280, the committee has never heard this bill before. It expands the scope of audits of business practices of school districts and education service districts to include performance audits. Removes a provision that allowed audits of only those districts that volunteered to be audited. It allows the State Board of Education to determine by rule how the audit expense will be shared between the department and the district. And it allows the Secretary of State to conduct audits business practices of districts without a contract with the department. The bill has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued. There are no amendments before you.
So it is the intent of the chair to move this bill without recommendation to the House Committee on Education.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move House Bill 2280 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the House Committee on Education.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2280 without recommendation as to passage to the floor, and the bill be referred to the House Committee on Education. Discussion? Seeing none, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Wizard? Aye.
Co-Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2280 is passed accordingly. Close the work session on House Bill 2280 and open a work session on House Bill 2095. Jan, can you give us a description of this bill, please?
Yes. Committee chairs, committee members, House Bill 2095. It enacts the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Compact, obligates Oregon to use uniform standards adopted by the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Commission, unless the state opts out of those specific standards. It designates the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services or the director's designee to serve on the commission. The bill has no revenue impact. A minimal fiscal impact has been determined with no statement issued. The committee heard the bill on February 10th, and there are no amendments before you.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
We're still in our discussion.
We have to have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Smith.
Yeah, I'll be a no. And I want to offer why and urge anybody who wants to join me to join me. From what I can tell, the primary impact of this will be to reduce the layer of oversight in Oregon. As we heard from our entertaining testimony, there have been times when Oregon's insurance regulators have caught things that other states haven't caught. And now that we're going to sort of have soft preemption towards the national network, kind of as an extra governmental body that might or might not be helpful, but I don't see I didn't hear any argument about how this would protect Oregon consumers or would increase the level of oversight. In fact, only heard an argument how it would decrease it. And there's never been a state that's ever removed itself from the network once it happened. And when hearing about there was a cost-saving mechanism, the department testified that they would not reduce staff or save any money from the move. So, other than moving towards more federally dominated policy, I don't see a really strong argument for doing it, so I'll be a no.
Other discussion, and I do note that the department is here in case someone would like to ask them a question. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the testimony by Representative Smith. I'd like to point out to the committee that it was endorsed by the agency. It was endorsed by the insurance community, and I will be supporting the bill, and I think it does provide some savings for the customers, and I think the department did say that although they would not reduce staff, they would provide them staff, they'd move that staff to other places where they could provide more services to other citizens and areas in their departments. So I'll be supporting the bill.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll also be supporting this. I think the fact that no one's ever removed themselves from the compact is a testament to its effectiveness, and it just offers more choice for the consumer. I really like this bill.
Representative Clem.
It wasn't the persuasive testimony of Representative Smith, but the opportunity to bury the hatchet with my once nemesis, Mr. Bill Sandu, presents itself today, and so I'll be voting no with Representative Smith.
A growing movement. Anybody's ready? Welcome to join.
Any other comments, questions from the committee? I will put on the record that I appreciate Representative Smith's concerns about this. However, I feel that consumers will be adequately protected, and perhaps even their protection will be enhanced by having 36, I believe, regulators around the state looking at insurance products, bringing up a lot more scrutiny over these insurance products, and as well having the ability to have the state opt out of any decision on those particular products gives me some comfort, so that if we have a good regulator with the consumer's interest at heart sitting at the table, I don't think that will diminish consumer protection any more than it would be diminished across the street with that same regulator. So with that, I will be supporting the bill. Seeing no other discussion on the bill, we have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Clark.
Nope.
Representative
Potter.
Aye.
Representative
Matthews. Aye.
Representative
Chair
Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
No.
Co-chief
Wisner.
Aye.
How do you really feel about this, Chair?
Chair Holby.
Aye. House Bill 2095, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor, and I will carry this particular bill. Thank you for the offers. With that, I will close work session on House Bill 2095. Jan, do we have anything else on our agenda?
The agenda is complete.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your attendance today. With that, I will adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.
It's been 18 years.